We continue our discussion of four-dimensional supersymmetry, right? And let's see. So what we did, we wrote a supersymmetry algebra in four dimensions, right? Q alpha dot Q bar alpha dot equals 2 sigma mu alpha alpha dot P mu, and then we had Q alpha Q beta equals Q alpha dot Q beta dot R equals to 0. And then P mu Q alpha equals P mu Q alpha dot bar equals to 0. So that's a supersymmetry algebra. And then much like we did in supersymmetric quantum mechanics, we tried to figure out the components of a supersymmetry multiplet. And so we did that. We did that in the case of a massive multiplet. Okay, so last time for a massive multiplet, so we analyzed how this supersymmetry algebra will look like on a massive multiplet once we go to a rest frame of these massive particles. And then we discovered that a massive supersymmetry multiplet contains the following components. So it contains component of spin spin j, j minus 1/2, j plus 1/2, and j. Okay, and so this is in case when j is not equal to 0. And in case that j equals to 0, then it's 0, 0, and 1/2, right? So those are the components of the massive supermultiplet when, you know, j is not equal and j equal to 0. This is what I said. So we did this analysis yesterday. So any questions at this stage? So right, guys, so some of you who just came a little bit later, so there is a first homework assignment. It will be up here, and it's also on the web. So, and after this, there will probably be one more homework assignment, and then we'll decide whether we will have a presentations or not. But I think the second homework assignment will be a bit more technical than this one. But all right, very good. So this is what we did last time. And so now we continue, and then we will study component structure of a massless SUSY multiplet. So the difference here is that I cannot go to a rest frame, but I still need to fix in some way the boost generators of a Lorentz group. And so what we will do, we will go into this frame where our massless multiplet moves along the z direction. So in this case, P mu takes this form. And so we can ask in this reference frame, what does our supersymmetry algebra look like? So the supersymmetry algebra will take this form. Okay, so then notice that I just have so in general, it's let me just go 2 sigma alpha alpha dot p mu, right? So our four vector p mu has only time-like component and component along the z direction. So the only matrices it will contribute here are sigma 0 and sigma 3. And so in particular, what this is sigma 3 minus sigma 0. And so if you substitute, this is just a third poly matrix. This is minus identity matrix. So you will get something like this, 0 and 0. All right? And so what this tells us that we can define define a new operators. We can define A alpha, which is Q alpha over root 2e, sorry, over 2, 2e, yes. And then I have A alpha dot, which I will define 1 over 2 root e Q alpha dot bar. And so if we do this rescaling, then the only non-trivial anti-commutator is going to be this. Okay, so I'm not gonna write dot. Once I have a bar, then this implies that this index is, has a dot, but I will not write it down. So so this anti-commutator is 1, and all other commutators, all other anti or commutators. Okay, would vanish. Okay, and so the idea is the same. We would like to build up a subsect of the Hilbert space using A1 bar, A2 bar. And so what we will do, we will, well, first of all, the algebra, because all other anti-commutators, well, if we talk about A's, then it will be just anti-commutators. I don't need to talk about Hamiltonians here, okay? So then, first of all, what we are dealing with is a two-dimensional Clifford algebra. And so this is actually completely equivalent to what we did in the supersymmetric quantum mechanics. So what I can do, I can define a ground state omega in such a way, a ground state in the multiplet, in such a way that it's being annihilated by A1. Okay. So my representation, the defining representation of this Clifford algebra will be two-dimensional. So I will have this state, and I will have a state when I will act with a raising operator. That's all what I will have in my Hilbert space, right? So there are just two states. Okay. So, so if this state, again, we have to recall now the representation of Lorentz group for massless particles, right? And so, as you remember, those massless particles are characterized by helicity, and so in particular, our supercharges, they carry Spinner index, and so they will have a specific helicity. So if we declare that this state has a helicity lambda, because A1 bar is just a rescaling of a Q1, and Q1 has a helicity 1/2, then this state will have a helicity 1/2 plus lambda. That's almost it, except that the series that we are dealing with will have CPT invariance. Okay, and so the CPT invariance tells us that if we have a multiplet with helicity, massless multiplet with helicity is lambda lambda plus 1/2, we also need particles with opposite helicity. Okay, so we, in other words, for massless particles, we would need to include in the CPT invariant theory. We also need to include particles with opposite helicities. So minus 1/2 minus lambda. And so the full massless SUSY multiplet will be minus lambda minus 1/2, will contain minus lambda, lambda, lambda plus 1/2, will contain four states. Okay? So we did a complete classification of supersymmetry multiplets. However, in this course, we will deal with mostly with renormalizable, well, I hate to say renormalizable field series because we will be talking about effective field series and that might include non-renormalizable interactions. But anyway, there will be a particular, we will not discuss most general supersymmetry multiplets and interacting field series of most general multiplets. Some of the reasons I will explain as we go. But the ones that we will consider, so we will consider only, so we consider only couple of SUSY representations. Okay, so the first one that we will consider is the so-called chiral multiplet. Well, so we'll consider massive and massless, okay? And I will talk only about massless. And, the extension to massive will be obvious, right? So so let's look at the massless multiplets. So the ones that we will consider are the one in which, for example, in which one of the states in the multiplet will have a helicity being zero. And so that's a scalar. So this is a chiral multiplet. Okay. So in a chiral multiplet, so I will use sometimes chiral superfield. Okay. So it's exactly the same as chiral multiplet. So I told you that that's a multiplet in which there is a state with a helicity zero. So given that that must be a content of the full SUSY multiplet, so we know that our multiplet must contain states of helicity zero, zero, and then helicities plus or minus 1/2. So we have two states of helicity zero, so we have two scalars. And in fact, those two scalars we can combine into a complex scalar. So you can think of it as either two real degrees of freedom or a complex scalar. A complex scalar. And then we can have a Weyl fermion, right? Okay. So we have scalar phi and we have psi alpha. Okay, so those are the component fields of the chiral multiplet. Okay. Now the other type of the multiplet we will consider because what we will be interested in a gauge series, and so we would like to include a multiplet which will include which will have a gauge boson, right? So we need a state with a helicity one. Okay. So we need, I cannot put lambda equal one immediately into that formula for the reasons that I will explain in a second. So, but I will write in words, we need a state in a multiplet of of helicity one. So naively, what I would appear to, what I can do, I can just substitute lambda equal one, but then notice that what I will have also a state of helicity 3/2. And that faces a problem because we do not know how to make an interacting So we can write down a free theory of spin 3/2, but we do not know as a field theory how to write down an interacting theory of spin 3/2 particles. Okay, so that's a problem. So since we don't want to do that, I cannot simply form a SUSY multiplate with with a state that has helicity 3/2. But there is another way how I can form a multiplet that will include a helicity 1 state. All I have to do is to start with lambda 1/2, right? If I start with a lambda 1/2, then I will have states in my supersymmetry multiplet, -1, -1/2, +1/2, and +1. So -1/2 and +1/2 are just the helicity states of a massless massless vector. So this is massless vector. And so this is again a Weyl fermion. So so another type of multiplet that we will look at would have a gauge boson, and it will have a corresponding fermion, Weyl fermion, and this guy, for example, in phenomenology, and we will use the same discussion, we will call, so this is a Gaugino. Gaugino or Fortino. Okay, sometimes you will see people would use the word Gaugino if they, Gaugino, Gluino, Fortino. It depends, it depends on the preference. For example, if we make this into an abelian gauge boson, then we would call this a Fortino. So if this is a non-abelian and we just have a pure Young-Mill theory, then I would call this a Gluino, and otherwise I would call it Gaugino. So Fortino, Fortino, Gluino. So those are the words that come for the superpartner of the vector boson in the SUSY multiplet. Okay. So as I said, in quantum field theory, we cannot study interactions of multiplets which contain spin 3/2, but we can do it in the supergravity. So in particular, in the supergravity contains a gravitino, which is a spin 3/2 field. We can have states of arbitrary high helicities and arbitrary high spins in string theory, but that's not what we're doing in this course. Okay, good. So before we go and start building up our Lagrangians and superspace and superfield formulas, I want to do some simple counting. Okay, so let's recall how the Higgs mechanism works, and I will show you. So we'll do some simple counting and see how the supersymmetric Higgs mechanism would work. So how does the Higgs mechanism work? So Higgs mechanism. Okay, so in a Higgs mechanism, what we do, so we have a gauge boson, right? So it's massless. And so it has two degrees of freedom, two propagating degrees of freedom. And so in order to have a Higgs mechanism, we need a Higgs field, right? So we can think of this just as a a real scalar. And so when there is a spontaneous symmetry breaking, so this is 1 degree of freedom, and so the scalar degree of freedom get absorbed into with vector degrees of freedom to form one massive vector, and as you know, the massive vector has 3 degrees of freedom. Okay, so let's just do this simple counting and see that it also makes sense when we extend this to supersymmetry multiplets. So in other words, this would be a very quick and dirty check whether it would have been possible to realize the Higgs mechanism in a supersymmetric series, whether we can realize accounting of this type while staying, while talking about, not about components, components of a supersymmetry multiplet, but talking about supersymmetry multiplets themselves. And so this simple counting shows that we indeed can do it, okay? So what I just erased is that the massive multiplet has states of this spin, right? J plus 1/2, J, so this is massive. Okay, so so when we talk about a massive vector, okay, so so for a massive vector, I will put J equal 1/2, and the multiplet that I have is 1/2. Well, so there is a state of zero spin, right? And then there are states of spin 1/2. So those are two Weyl fermions. So this is a real scalar. And then I have a vector boson, right? So then I have a spin one massive spin one state, and that this is a massive vector. Okay. So good. And you can see that indeed we have the same number of bosonic and fermionic degrees of freedom. This guy has 3 plus 1, it's 4, and each of the Weyl fermions have 2 degrees of freedom. Now a massless vector, again, I'm talking in a context of a supersymmetry multiplet, so you have to think of this as a massless supersymmetry multiplet containing a vector. We just talked about that, right? So it has so it was it had a single Weyl fermion, and it had a vector, right? So this is two degrees of freedom. So this was one Weyl fermion. And this was our massless vector. And this massless vector has also 2 degrees of freedom. And so what we see, we can ask the question, so what is the difference in terms of degrees of freedom to go from a massless vector to a massive vector? Or what should a massless vector absorb during the symmetry breaking in order to become a massive vector? And you can see that what needs to be done is that you need additional Weyl fermion, right? So you have a Weyl fermion. You need one Weyl fermion. So missing component. So there is a Weyl fermion, and then there are two scalars missing. Okay, why there are two scalars? Because this guy doesn't have any scalar here, so 2 times 0. I'm going to write it down this way. And also there is a 1 degree of freedom missing, depending whether we have a massless or a massive vector. So altogether there are 2 bosonic degrees of freedom missing, but this guy has exactly the same component structure as a chiral multiplet, right? A chiral multiplet. So remember, a chiral multiplet had a Weyl fermion, one Weyl fermion, and a single complex scalar. So what we see an example of a Higgs mechanism where we have a massless vector, schematically, something like what we discussed there, which will combine with a chiral multiplet. And it will form a massive vector multiplet. So at least at the level of counting of the number of degrees of freedom, we see that it should be possible to realize a Higgs mechanism in supersymmetric models. And indeed, it is possible. Maybe when we will have time, we will talk about that. And that's known as a super Higgs mechanism. All right? Very good. So we are done with counting. As I said, what we need to proceed further to superspace and superfield, we need to remember particle content of a chiral multiplet, complex scalar and wild fermion, and a massless vector. So it's a wild fermion and a vector. And so for now, much like when you study quantum field theory, you start with scalar quantum field theories. So we will start with interacting. So what we will do now, we will study supersymmetric interactive theories of chiral superfields. Okay. And after that, we will include the vector multiplet and discuss supersymmetric gauge theories. All right. So good. So you will see that very similar. I'm not going to be that pedagogical as we've been in supersymmetric quantum mechanics, and we'll just go through the statements and we'll be verifying statements. Okay, so we will start immediately by introducing n equal 1 superspace. So in order to introduce n equal 1 superspace, we will extend the space-time coordinates by Grassmann parameters with dotted and undotted indices. So now a point in our superspace is labeled by x mu, is labeled by theta alpha, and theta bar alpha dot. You can see that you have in a superspace, as you expect, the same number of bosonic and fermionic coordinates. There are four bosonic coordinates. There are two fermionic with undotted. And two fermionic dotted ones. Now, once I tell you the superspace, I can define a supertranslation . So by definition, a supertranslation, it's an operation which takes a point on superspace and moves it to a different point according to the following rule, x mu plus I theta sigma mu psi bar minus I psi sigma mu theta bar plus. So super translations are translations along the fermionic coordinates. Now we have dotted and undotted ones. And so in order to identify the translations, I had to introduce if you wish, two infinitesimal parameters. How do we call this letter, psi? I keep calling it psi, but it's zeta, right? So, okay, so zeta alpha and, sorry, say it again, psi. Okay, good. I never remember that. So psi alpha and psi bar, have to put bar here as well. Okay, good. So, again, we'll take this as a definition. Now, if we take this as a definition, we can ask the question, what are the differential operators? What are the differential operators that generate those super translations? So I'm gonna make the I'm going to write down the answer. Okay. All right. So unfortunately, I'm going to use the variable. So Q alpha, they. Okay. Well, let me just write down without saying anything. So those two differential operators I claim are the ones that correspond to those super translations, and we will check this in a second, right? So I have alpha dot del mu, okay? And then I have Q alpha dot bar, which is minus del over del theta bar alpha dot. And then I have plus I sigma mu alpha alpha dot, and I have theta alpha left. I will have theta alpha sigma mu alpha alpha dot del mu. All right. So there are two things to notice. So when I take a derivative here, my Grassmann variable has an upper index, okay? And after I take a derivative, I have to interpret the object as an object that would carry a lower index, right? That's a clear thing. So if we start with something that is a Lorentz scalar, so it's a contraction of a spinor indices. So if I differentiate with respect to a Grassmann variable with an upper index, I will get something with a lower index. That's why we have lower here. Okay, and again, so I'm assuming summation over repeated indices. So the question to ask is why those differential operators correspond to translations. And the reason for that is actually very straightforward. So suppose I have a function x mu, this function depends also on Grassmann coordinates as well. I'm going to ask how does this function transform under supertranslation. So what's delta F due to supertranslations? Okay. So what we want to do, we want to write the variation of the function in this form. We want to write it as xi q alpha, okay, and then plus xi bar q bar, okay. So I guess I will write it down in this way, we will use our convention. So what this means xi alpha q alpha, this must act on the function f. This guy. Remember our convention for the contraction of barred spinors or spinors with dotted indices is that the first spinor carries lower index and the other one carries upper index, acted on F. So, yes. Sorry, yes, you're right. This is Q bar. This is a differential operator. Yeah. Q bar. So psi alpha, Q alpha. So what I'm going to do here, as you will see, it's easier to extract the pieces for these differential operators if I look at lower indices. And in fact, the way how those operators are written, we have for the Q bar, we have a lower index. So I will have a minus sign. Because there is a minus sign if I change how I contract the indices, if the first index is upper or lower, acted on F, okay? So this is just how I would have defined differential operators corresponding to translations. But now I can just compute. I know what will happen how my what's my delta f after I do the supertranslation? Well, it will be just x mu, right? And then I will have plus I theta sigma mu psi bar minus I psi sigma mu theta bar, right? And then I have to translate the theta coordinates, okay? And then I have to subtract the value of the function we had before. So what I can do, I can just do a Taylor series expansion. There. And so you can see that that thing is, I will have I theta sigma mu psi bar, okay, minus I psi sigma mu theta bar del mu of f. That will come from shifting the x coordinate there by this much. Okay, so we are doing the infinitesimal translations in Grassmann variables. And then there will be plus psi alpha. So I have del f over del theta alpha plus psi alpha dot bar del f over del theta bar alpha dot. Okay, so it's all very straightforward. And then what you have to do is to pretty much write down what you have here in this form. Okay, and so let's see what will happen. Right? So this combination here, so this is theta alpha sigma mu alpha dot psi bar alpha dot, right? So this is the combination that will contribute to the other one. This is the one that will contribute to the first one. So I will have psi alpha, right? So there will be a piece coming from here. So it will be minus I sigma mu alpha dot theta bar alpha dot, right? And I need to act with del mu here. And then there is another piece, which is this, plus del over del theta alpha. And you can recognize that that's indeed exactly what we call q alpha. Then I have minus, okay? I want to write it down in exactly this form, right? So psi bar alpha dot, right? So I have to look here, okay? So there is a plus sign here. I need a minus, so I have a minus, sign. But then in order for me to write down the psi coordinate first, I need to anti-commute theta and psi. So there will be three minus signs altogether, right? So there will be one minus, okay, let me put it easy. If I anti-commute, there will be a minus sign which is taken care of here, and so it will give me plus, right, sigma mu, plus theta alpha sigma mu alpha dot, which is the correct part here, and it must come with del mu. With del mu. And then we have this piece, okay? So in this piece, since I factored a minus sign, so it will come with minus sign, del over del theta alpha dot, okay? So, and this guy has to act on f. All right? And this is something that we identified as q bar alpha dot. All right, so any questions here? Good. So, yeah.
Do you have nowhere bars on your sigma mu's?
No, we don't have. But sigma mu's are Hermitian matrices, right?
Okay, so
there is, right, so something that we will need later, something that you will need for your homework assignment, I believe, at some stage. So this is the way how we define the sigma matrix. So we're assuming that sigma matrix carries one lower undotted and one lower dotted digit. But there is also this element. Okay. So this one we put a bar on it. But notice the difference is that this guy has upper indices. So what we actually have, so I need to use two epsilon symbols. So remember that the metric in this inner space is epsilon alpha beta. So I need to use epsilon alpha beta to lower or raise indices. So this tells me that I should use two epsilons, right? Alpha beta, sigma mu beta, beta dot. So this is some identities that I wrote long time ago, but so we're already from that. Yeah. So there is no bars for now. So those guys are written in the worst possible way. I need them probably all day today. Okay. All right. So now here comes the difference from supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And so there are two ways to deal with these differences. Either to make quantum mechanics look nice, or to have this issue that I have here. So the expansion that Philip Argyros paid in his lecture notes is that he has a Hamiltonian with the wrong sign compared to what people define in normal quantum mechanics. So the price that I pay here is that, remember, in supersymmetric quantum mechanics, and I actually didn't thought long time ago how to resolve this issue. Remember, in supersymmetric quantum mechanics, there were these differential operators, and those differential operators realized the supersymmetry algebra, right? So we realized those guys as having this computation relations. And then we introduce a covariant derivative, and covariant derivative as a differential operator. So satisfy a supersymmetry algebra with the wrong sign. So this is what we had before.
So what is happening now in SUSY field series? So this is what I call supercharges, right? I use the same notation as for the supercharges in the supersymmetry algebra as for the operators that generate translations along the Grassmann variables. You can do the algebra and you will find out Q alpha dot bar as a differential operator. It's equal minus two sigma mu alpha dot p mu. So it has a wrong sign, okay? However, so pretty much the role of Q and covariant derivatives will get switched as we go from quantum mechanics to supersymmetric quantum field theory. Now, having said that, okay, so I said that this will generate supersymmetry algebra, the translation, super translation generators with the wrong sign, but there are covariant derivatives, okay? So I can define covariant derivatives in this way. So I just switch signs in front of del mu, right? So there was a minus sign here for Q alpha, so there is a plus sign here, okay? And I need theta bar alpha dot. And then I have this guy, minus d over d theta alpha dot, and There is a minus sign here. I need a theta alpha sigma mu alpha alpha dot del mu. Now, it's clear that if I claim that those guys satisfy an algebra, and of course, I'm assuming that P mu has a standard differential operator representation, so it's minus I del mu. So these guys actually have a correct supersymmetry algebra. So this is just 2P alpha alpha dot. All right, so let's proceed. So we have our superspace. We defined our super translations, and we defined something that I will call a covariant derivatives, right? So we will do this later. So those are covariant of super covariant derivatives. And I think what I need to mention for the future is, much like in a supersymmetric quantum mechanics, just because they are super covariant derivatives, they better anti-commute with super translation generators, and that's indeed the case. So so what you can do, you can show so d alpha and q beta should better anti-commute. And again, much like in supersymmetric quantum mechanics, this was necessary for d alpha to be a super covariant derivative. And so in this case, we can just straightforwardly verify, I'm not going to do this, that these anti-commutators, these anti-commutators vanish. So 59, 60. Very good. So good. So now we move to superfields. So so much like, again, in quantum mechanics, superfield is a most general function we can write down on a superspace. So what this means? This means that our superfield phi, right? So it's a function on a superspace. So it depends on the coordinate x, and it depends on the Grassmann coordinate. So much like in the case of a supersymmetric quantum mechanics, we can try to figure out what is the most general form here. And so in order to get the most general form, you can think of that we are doing Taylor expansion in theta bar. Okay, and again, like in quantum mechanics, the Taylor expansion will terminate because we cannot have two identical Grassmann variables. The square of them will vanish. And so I'm going to write down what we will have. So the most general expansion that you can write down will take this form. Okay, let me remove this x. I'll say it just in the words. Okay, so in this case, I can have theta squared. What I mean by that, theta squared is theta alpha, theta bar squared is theta alpha bar dot. So so theta squared will not vanish because, remember, our Grassmann variable is either a left-handed or a right-handed fermion. So there are two indices here. So in particular here, this is theta 1 times theta 2, proportional to theta 1, theta 2. Right, so I have these guys, plus I can write down more things, theta bar a mu plus theta squared theta bar lambda bar plus theta bar squared theta rho plus theta squared theta bar squared d. Okay, so you can see that, so first of all, let's let you guys look at the blackboard and convince yourself that that's the most general form you can have. So I wrote the most general expansion in theta bar, and assume that all the fields are different. So altogether, we have fields phi, psi, chi bar, f, g, a mu, lambda bar, rho, and d. Okay? So the most general superfield is a horrible mess. But that's the most general. We cannot be, we are not missing anything. Now here comes a funny thing. That's what we discussed before about the particle content of a supersymmetry multiplet. Notice that in doing this expansion, I never said what the spin this guy has. Okay, so you might assume that it's a scalar, but I never said that it's a scalar. It's just that I never wrote its indices, so it might carry tons of Lorentz indices. The only thing that I care is that suppose that this guy has a spin J. So what spin this guy will have? J plus or minus 1/2, right? Those guys, just by their, each of the theta has a Lorentz spin 1/2, so just addition of momentum tells me that if this guy, okay, I think it's better for me to write down here. Oh, beautiful, I can raise it. So this guy has a spin J, so those guys have spin J plus or minus 1/2, okay? So then I have F and G, right? However, this is anti-symmetric combination, so it doesn't carry any, it doesn't change the spin, right? So those guys carry spins J as well. But then I have a mu, okay? Well, this guy carries a spin 1, right? So if we take this particular combination, notice that all spin indices are contracted, and we are left with a single vector index. So that's an indication that as an object, that will transform as a vector under Lorentz transformations. But then this means that I am adding two objects. I'm adding two momenta, and one of the momenta is 1, and I need to get a momenta J. So this tells me that this A mu is actually the object that can carry spin plus J plus or minus 1. Okay, those guys carry J plus or minus 1/2, and these again can carry spin J only. Is that clear? Okay, so what we did a most general expansion, and you can see that it's actually really funny because we never saw in our discussion of a supersymmetry multiplet, we never saw a supersymmetry multiplet that has that has that many components, and that has components. So you can see that we have components ranging from J minus 1 to J plus 1. So in other words, a general superfield, as we discuss right now, has too many components. Has too many components. To be in irreducible representation. Of SUSY algebra, right? Our analysis before identified a full supersymmetry multiplet, and moreover, we identified an irreducible supersymmetry multiply. So what we are finding now is that if we write down the most general superfield, it contains way more components than what we expect for an irreducible supermultiplet. So what that means that it's actually not a one supermultiplet, but it's a collection of couple supermultiplets. And that's what we will be, that's what we will find. However, I will not go into a long story, how do we find it. I'll just mention how to put, so in other words, we need to put constraint on the most general superfield to bring it down to an irreducible representation of a supersymmetry algebra. So the outcome of our discussion, so we need to constrain general superfield to obtain irreducible representation of SUSY algebra. Okay, and I said there are two quantum field theories, two types of quantum field theories that we will study, and that actually corresponds to two different ways how you can impose a constraint on a superfield. So the one that we will study today, and likely tomorrow, so it's a chiral superfield. So it's a chiral superfield constraint. Okay. So rather than looking at the most general superfield, we will look at the superfields which are chiral, and that's a notion that familiar from quantum mechanics. So except that here it will be a non-trivial statement. So we will look at the chiral superfields are superfields which are annihilated by d bar covariant derivative. Okay, similarly, we can look at anti-chiral superfields. So this is anti-chiral. Anti-chiral superfield. Okay, constraint. So this, in this case, that's a superfield which is annihilated by D. Okay, I still call it just the second one is literally everything we say here can be literally repeated here. So I would consider this as a one type of constraint. And that, so study a general superfields with this constraint will lead us to the quantum interacting field theory that involves chiral superfields. So it will be interacting field theories that involve wild fermions and scalars, no gauge fields. So this does not allow us to study gauge theories. However, there is a different type of constraint. And it's known as a vector constraint, and you might have guessed that that's a constraint that should restrict the general superfield to irreducible components of vector supermultiplet. That's indeed the case. So, well, actually, I don't know, vector constraint. Sometimes it's also, well, it better, you know, from the operational perspective, it's just a reality constraint. Okay, so a reality constraint is actually much simpler than that, but you will see that, you will see later that constructing a series is more complicated with this. So it's just a constraint that our superfield is invariant as we take bar. So that's a reality constraint. And so I said that it's also a vector constraint. So if we take a general superfield and impose this constraint, then we will get an irreducible vector multiplet. Okay? And we will see this. We will see this in detail. But as I said, what we will start with, we will start with studying this. All right, guys. So any questions? No. All right. Let's move on. Yes.
N equal one because so this is a minimal extension of the Lorentz algebra, right? So the minimal extension involves I can phrase it in the language of superspaces we are doing, right?
So what we are doing, we have four bosonic coordinates, right? X mu. So the minimal extension of that, in order to make it supersymmetric, we need four Grassmann coordinates. Okay, so so if we have four Grassmann coordinates, there is a translation associated with each of the four Grassmann coordinates in order to make it into a superspace. So each of the translations shows up as a supersymmetry generator. And that's a minimal extension. So minimally extended it in four dimensions, you will need four supersymmetry generators. But that's something that, you know, remember in the, at the very beginning, we studied Coleman-Mandula theorem. And we concluded that there is only one way to extend it. And it was by including the fermionic charges, right? So, so it's called N equal one. So there will be maybe later, it depends how fast I can go now from now on. It's hard for me to judge the speed yet, honestly. So I don't know how far we will go. But maybe at the end we will study the Seiberg-Witten series. So Seiberg-Witten series are the series where you have actually not four supersymmetry generators, but eight. So in some sense, the series that we are studying is the series that has a minimal number of supersymmetry generators. You cannot have less than that in four dimensions. We study series in four dimensions. You can have more, but again, not too many more. The maximal number of supersymmetry generators, you can show, you cannot have more than 16, okay? More than 16 normal generators, but then if you have a conformal symmetry, then there will be superconformal generators as well. So altogether, you will have 32 fermionic generators, and that will give you n equal 4 supersymmetric Young nil. So, so we start with n equal 1, the minimal number of supercharges. It turns out there are similar formalisms, so you can ask, okay, so here it's very straightforward how you form a superspace, and there is a very intuitive idea why this is a minimal supersymmetry, because I told you it just simply comes from the fact that there is a nice superspace interpretation. We start with four bosonic coordinates that we observe, and we added the same number of fermionic coordinates. Doing a similar thing is obviously non-trivial if we stay still in four dimensions and we want to include the, to increase the number of supersymmetry generators. Everything that I know suggests that so there is an extension to, there is a superspace formalism for the extended supersymmetries. All other supersymmetries are called extended. However, it's not very useful. So at the end of the day, even if we study extended supersymmetry, we will still be using n equal one formalism. Much like when, remember when we studied supersymmetric quantum mechanics, we didn't have to study superfields. We did it in components. Now here we skipped completely that part. And we discussed supersymmetric quantum field theories starting from a superfield formalism. So the same thing you can ask, if I have an extended supersymmetry, is it more useful to study it using, superfields in extended superspace? And the answer is no. So it just, it's not very useful. So that's why we will stick with this. So this is basic, and that's actually, to a large extent, all what's needed.
Question: how do we know that a superfield, which is basically a general function of superspace, that it's a representation? It doesn't seem to be invariant in the translation to superspace.
not yet, but that's what I was trying to. So this is what that's what we're gonna go and discuss. In fact, I noticed that you looked funny when I said the vector constraint. And indeed, if you look, it looks like that a vector will still have more components than what we discussed for a vector superview. However, what we will show that bunch of them is just related with gauge symmetry.
So they can be gauged away. So there is a supersymmetric generalization of gauge symmetries, and so that can be removed. Now, to answer your first question, how do we know that, you know, we take this general superfield and it has components? You will see it in a second, that it will have the right number of components when we're going to discuss now chiral superfields. You can go ahead and do the same trick that we did in supersymmetric quantum mechanics. So we know how the supersymmetry transformation acts on the superfield. It's basically, in this case, it will be by this operator, right? So those are differential operators. And I will do some of the exercises so you will see that somebody gives you a superfield, you can read off how does it act. And then you can do the same tricks that we did in supersymmetric quantum mechanics. You ask, how does my particular component of the superfield transform under the supersymmetry transformation? So you can do that. I don't think I will do that.
The superfield itself doesn't change under this transformation. How do you know it's
changing? It does, right? So in fact, this is what I want you to write down. So the supersymmetry transformation of the superfield is this. But I don't quite understand your question, because whenever I do that, you agree that what we wrote there is the most general way of writing a
superfield on a superspace. So I guess your question is, how do I know that if I start with a chiral superfield, that after I do supersymmetry transformation, I will still have a chiral superfield?
Well, how do you know that you have a supersymmetry invariant theory? Because if you have, as you write down, delta Susie on phi, it's not zero.
But it's not zero. It wasn't zero in supersymmetric quantum mechanics, right? It was a question, once we construct the Lagrangian built out of superfield, we want that once we act with this supersymmetry transformation on our Lagrangian, it will give us total derivatives, so that the action will be invariant. That's what it means. In fact, it would have been it wouldn't make much sense to require that the field is invariant under the supersymmetry transformation. So it just doesn't transform. So there is it's not part of the I don't know. It's like, you know, trying to study electromagnetism with massless particles, with chargeless, chargeless particles. It's okay. But it's exactly the same as in supersymmetric quantum mechanics. But your question has a is something where I wanted to start the discussion, because it's entirely not clear. Now I'm telling you that the general superfield has too many components. So if we act with a supersymmetry transformation, it doesn't immediately imply that we stay within
the less number of components. The chiral superfield has less number of components. And so the things that I need to prove is that the constraint, in particular the chiral superfield constraint, is invariant under supersymmetry transformations. In other words, what I need to show that the transformation, the change in the superfield is such that the superfield remains chiral, right? But that's an obvious statement. Okay, so this implies that delta susi acts on chiral superfield. We will still have a chiral superfield. Now the reason why this is the case is because our covariant derivatives anti-commute with Q. And so the reason why this is trivial, so this is trivial because because psi q and d bar, so this commutator will vanish, right? So d anti-commutes with q, and so d bar will commute with psi q. Okay? And so what we showed that the constraint, that's the first important step, is invariant on the SUSY transformations. And if you think that's exactly what is needed in order to cut a reducible representation into an irreducible representation, you impose constraints, and whatever you impose should better be invariant under the transformations. All right, so very good. Yes, please.
I mean, maybe it's distracting, but what happens if you, I mean, have people consider studying local supersymmetry?
Yeah, that's the drag.
So, when, I mean, local in the sense that psi depends on position?
Yeah, but in this way you will find out gravity and you will find out the simple gravity model. Yeah. Any more questions? And that's really too distracting. But that's, no, it's okay. It's a very interesting question, and I would love at some stage to go into that in the course, but it's impossible in one semester. Yes, please.
Okay, yeah, can we find the constraint?
No. The answer to that question is no. Those are the two known. So, honestly, I don't know the answer, but I don't know if the answer is known whether those are the most general type of constraints. I think the answer is yes. Because we analyzed with you the particle content of supersymmetry multiplets, and now I'm claiming that sort of different. Well, again, if we restrict to a renormalizable series, a renormalizable interacting series, we have to restrict to super multiplets with spins less than 3/2, and so we classify them all. So in other words, as far as the normalizable quantum supersymmetric renormalizable quantum series, we are set. They cannot, we are not missing anything.
Okay, so if you consider extended supersymmetry?
If we consider extended supersymmetry, then things are more complicated there. So for example, there is no, I could be wrong, it's been a while since I looked at that, but sometimes, so you have a supersymmetry algebra, right? And so sometimes the supersymmetry algebra in general, so the way how we formulated it in n equal 1 supersymmetry, it's valid off shell, right? So we looked at the field and we never cared whether the field satisfy equation of motion or not. So very often in theories with extended supersymmetry, this extended supersymmetry algebra is not valid off shell. It's valid only on shell. So in other words, there is no, if you wish, there is, if you think the things that allow you to extend the supersymmetry off shell is the inclusion of this auxiliary fields. I don't know if you've been previous. Last time, but we talked about the F. Actually, this was in supersymmetric quantum mechanics, right? There was an auxiliary field F that did not contribute to anything. But the role of that superfield F was precisely in order to complete the supersymmetry algebra off shell. To close the supersymmetry algebra off shell. So here, you can see that there is, we will be discussing, and what we will find out is there is, you can see there is this F. It also will be a non-propagating, non-dynamical degree of freedom in other supersymmetric Lagrangians. But we will need it. We need it, and you will see in a second that it's needed when we start writing down the superfield. It will be part of the component. And if you think that that thing is actually needed in order also to close supersymmetry algebra off shell as well. Mm-hmm. However, such a structure, if you wish the general expansion, what's the general structure? The general superfield in the case of extended supersymmetry is a complicated question. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if the answer is known to it in general. I suspect not.
Okay.
At least that's my recollection in the context of an equal to supersymmetry.
So is that the mechanism that extend supersymmetry, extend superfield forms is not useful?
That makes it difficult, right? So because again, you do have an extended supersymmetry, but it's all only on shell. There is no off shell if you wish realization of that. More questions? No. All right. So very good. So now, now we will do what I promised you to see to some of the very nice discussions that we have to see why we need some components, right? So let's try to solve this constraint in all generality. So we find the solution to this equation. Solve in general. Okay. So the way we're going to do this is much like we did in supersymmetric quantum mechanics. We're going to find chiral coordinates. Okay. So find chiral coordinates. And I'm just going to make a statement that, well, one chiral coordinate is theta alpha. So I guess I have to write down what E is to remind you. So E bar minus del over del theta bar plus I sigma alpha sigma mu alpha. So I believe that's correct. Let me double check. Nope. This is a correct thing. So let's be careful. All right. So very good. So you can see that D will annihilate theta alpha, right? And D bar will also annihilate Y mu. And Y mu is, by definition, is X mu plus I theta sigma mu theta bar. Okay. So so we can check this, right? So we have we need to act with this operator on this, right? So if I act here, so this is a derivative, so I need to add the commute this past. So there will be a minus sign, and with this minus sign, it will be in plus. So I will have plus I theta sigma mu. Okay. So it will come from this piece. And now from this piece, you can see there is a minus sign, so there is minus I, and then I have theta sigma mu, right? And then this guy will initialize it. Okay. So I have plus something minus exactly the same, equal to zero, so y mu is a chiral coordinate. So this tells me that I can make a chiral superfield by saying that instead of depending separately on x theta and theta bar, I can say that the chiral superfield, so this will make a chiral, if we make it depend on our y coordinate and theta only and nothing else, then that will guarantee that, so then this will imply the d bar acted on phi, that is a function of y and theta, that it will vanish. So that's indeed a chiral superfield. So now, now I have this chiral superfield, y and theta, and I want to do a Taylor series expansion of it. And so what I'm writing is a convention. So there is phi of y, okay? So what I'm doing a Taylor series expansion in this Grassmann parameter.
So we scale and expand.
Then conventionally there is a root 2 there,
okay? And then there is theta squared f as a function of 1.
Okay. So I cannot have anything else, right? Because I'm doing expansion in theta, and there are only two theta, theta 1 and theta 2, so I cannot have theta q. So this phi, I'm going to make a complex, is a complex scalar. So this guy is, so more precisely, phi of x, okay? So y is a funny kind of ordinate, but phi of x is a complex scalar. This is a wild terminal. And so you can see that I already have the right, once I told you this, then this is 2 degrees of freedom. This is 2 degrees of freedom. This guy, if I think of this as a complex scalar, so naively also 2 degrees degrees of freedom. However, this guy is an auxiliary field. Okay, so it will not have any propagating degrees of freedom. We will see it. We will build our supersymmetric actions. And so we have the correct counting as required by supersymmetry, same number of Bosonic, same number of fermionic degrees of freedom. Moreover, we have the particle content corresponding to a chiral multiplet. And you can see that, for example, here, there is no way I can avoid not having this.
Right. So that's so I need this field will come up naturally when I try to build up a superfield formulation for a chiral superfield. But it doesn't have any dynamics. It will be non-dynamical field. It has a name. It's an auxiliary field. So we did not have this phenomena in supersymmetric quantum mechanics. So all the fields that we saw there. F was non-dynamical there as well. But more precisely, we have to be careful how we count degrees of freedom in a superfield, because some of the components of superfield can be non-dynamical. And so that's our first example of that. All right, guys, so let's see.
Well, there's 2 extra degrees of freedom.
Yes.
So are there also 2 extra fermionic degrees of freedom? No. But the supersymmetry is, you know, it's clear. I told you that. Think of it. So you agree that this is the most general expansion of a chiral superfield. You agree with that? Now, you agree also with the argument that the supersymmetry variation of the chiral superfield is a chiral superfield. So that tells me that there will be a unique way which will tell me exactly how each of those guys will transform. So in other words, there will be a nice, well-defined supersymmetry algebra that will close off shell. So, however, the question how many propagating degrees of freedom I have will be 2 from here, 2 from here, and 0 from there. So there are examples. There are examples of ordinary quantum field theory, which is, for example, a theory of 2-form. So if you write down a theory of 2-form, there is some old paper by Witten where he did a canonical analysis, and he showed that So there is, you're going to write down some effective action, but if you do canonical quantization, you will find out that it has 0 number of propagating degrees of freedom. Yeah.
But does that So that's true for any action that you can write down, it's symmetric under the curve?
Yes, we will do, so we will write down the most general action. We will see that no matter what we're going to write down, this F is going to be a non-dynamical field, and it will, we will integrate it out. And so at the end of the day, if we're going to write down what is the action, so see, the superfield formalism is just a trick. It allows us to easily write down the supersymmetric actions. At the end of the day, we have our action given in terms of components. So my claim is that once we get to that action, then the only thing that we will see in that action is a complex scalar and a complex wild vector. So we will have the same number of Lusonic and Kerfelian degrees of freedom. And so again, the superfield is just a trick to help us formulate in a fast way supersymmetric actions. All right, guys?
Okay, so it doesn't make sense for me to continue because I would have to repeat from from what I will say in these 3 minutes. So again, there is a homework assignment. It's here and it's also on the web page. And now there will be homework assignments more often because